Welcome, my friends, to the Memorial Day edition of Bo Snerdley's Rush Hour here on WABC. If you'd like to be part of the program this afternoon, 800-848-9222 is how you reach us. 800-848-9222. As I said, it is Memorial Day. Well, we're celebrating Memorial Day, and so we have our historian with us today, Dean Karyanis, who for many years worked with me and with others on the Rush Limbaugh Show. Dean was one of the amazing web producers. As those of you who listen to the program regularly know and who've heard Dean before, he also runs a website that you should check out if you are at all interested in history, historyauthor.com. Fascinating interviews with the authors of books dealing, of course, with history. In addition to that, Dean and his wife also authored a book that is, you should, if you love Greek cuisine, if you're interested in it, if you like cooking, which I don't. But the book is still
great.
There's
a lot of vegan. There's a lot of vegan and vegetarian stuff in there. You might be surprised.
Yeah, but I still don't like cooking. I mean, I like to read it and then tell other people, hey, you should check out this recipe in Dean's book so you can cook it for me. That's how that works, Dean.
Yeah, you can come over anytime and we'll feed you. That's one of a Greek's favorite things to do. And look at me stepping on my intro. But I'm getting modest here anyway. I'm getting red-faced. I can't take it. The columnist at the New York Sun, that was your last thing. People can check me out. They can find us.
Thank you.
This is a day about the fallen, so I don't want to make it too much about me. I'll be modest.
Well, this is a day about the fallen. And, Dean, I do want to talk about Memorial Day. We usually do that straight up. I wanted to throw a curveball at you today. I want to talk about current news with you, a few news stories, and then just have you for a few segments, and then we'll talk about Memorial Day and what it means. There's stuff that has been happening in the news. First of all, Dean, I want to get your reaction to the Trump rally in the Bronx last week.
How about that? I always thought from when he started that the way that as president, Trump would grow his coalition and win the popular vote and hope to get a second term would have been to go into the cities, would have been to go after voters who were disaffected with the Democrats and taken for granted so many times, for so many years and so many times. And I think he was just beginning to do that with things like the pardons and reform of some of the criminal justice reform laws. And then he got interrupted, of course, by the pandemic, as we all did. And I think this was a good example of where he is bringing that message and how it's resounding with people. The lady who began that rally, I thought to myself, she should be speaking in a primetime slot at the Republican National Convention. We all complain about these conventions. They're old. The networks don't want to even cover them anymore. And I thought he should be putting those speakers out there, these real people, this woman who's saying, I can't choose between filling my fridge with food and doing my laundry because those quarters matter so much to me. I would much rather hear her, and I'll tell you, I would throw a little political spin in this, and I would, if I was the Trump campaign, I would say, offer this spot to President George W. Bush. And I bet he rejects it. If he comes, fine. Well, when, I bet you he rejects it, say, okay, we're going to put this woman in this spot and let her have the spot we were going to have for the former president. Because, you know, we don't have a lot of great memories. And President George W. Bush, who we spent all those years rooting for, has decided he'd rather be liked on a lot of things by the people who tried to destroy him. And President Trump has been perfectly willing to say, okay, yeah, I said from the beginning I didn't like the Iraq war. And so I think that could be a potentially really good way to do it. But specifically about the rally was that when you hear from that, I listened to an MTA discussion. I've been writing a lot at the New York Sun about congestion pricing. You hear people who say, I can't ride the subway at night. A lady like this lady, I wish I could remember her name, who started it. It's too dangerous for me at work. I get out of work at 1 a.m. I can't ride the subway. I have to drive. Or I can't afford that. I can't afford to be paying $15 when I come in for my job. That's the first hour that I'm going to work on my 8-hour shift that I'm paying to the city. And I think people have so lost that. And President Trump connects with people in a way that it may bother people. And I think President Biden does this too. Everyone who knows him says, yeah, he's really great one-on-one, or was back in the day. But I think because for the obvious reasons, and being a New Yorker, talk about a gregarious people. I think it's such a strength of his when he goes out there and can connect and understand. He worked with people who shower after work, as they say, and not before work. He knows those tradesmen. He knows the people in the bodegas. He knows what all of those jobs mean. And I think that empathy, I also wrote at the New York Sun, not to keep plugging myself, but about the empathy gap that Biden has, where he used to be, oh, he's so empathetic. And I mean, look at Hawaii. He's completely forgotten about Hawaii. And I think
I want to get back to that with the empathy, but you're bringing up Joe Biden. So let's finish your point on Biden and the empathy. And then I want to talk about two Biden stories that are in the news today.
All right, great. I'm happy to set you up. You go in and you say to President Biden, this horrible thing happened. I just lost, for instance, those three soldiers we lost in Jordan. And he starts talking about his son, Bo, which is a tragedy for him. But he can only seem to relate anymore to things that happened to him. And I think to look at him that way and say, you used to be the guy who everything was empathy. You understood. He went through terrible tragedies in his life, his early life, losing his wife and his daughter in that car. But now he seems to have just made that the only trick that he seems to remember. He doesn't have that empathy. And I think that rally in the Bronx showed you so many people coming out from all walks of life. And when that woman fainted, that was such a great moment. I mean, she's fine, so I could say it was a great moment. But he stopped that rally cold to make sure that woman was okay. So are there any doctors in the house? Thank God he didn't, like President Obama, ask if there was a paralegal when he meant paramedics, because that was a big story. But he went ahead. He stopped it. He kept saying, are you okay, darling? Take your time, everybody. And it wasn't for the cameras. He was just having a genuine moment. There's always those moments, and you know, because Rush pointed them out so often, there's always some time in those speeches where he makes people feel welcomed and special, and he thanks them. And instead of just rolling right back to his prepared remarks, he brought that thing to a dead stop for maybe, I don't know, 4 minutes. It's an eternity. I was surprised that he took so much time, but that means so much to people out there who are struggling, who don't feel seen, who don't feel heard, who just feel ignored and walked on, and they have people in Washington, specifically the White House, as the embodiment of Washington, the president, talking down to them and telling them, we know what's best for you. I think that rally was incredible.
All right, so Joe Biden, speaking of Bo Biden, made a surprise visit in the middle of the night on Saturday to the widow of Bo Biden. Now, Bo Biden, we must remind people, passed away on May 30th. So we are days away from the anniversary of that, his son Bo. He did not, as the president has said many times, die in a war theater. He died fighting cancer. But nonetheless, Biden stopped to see Haley Biden, the widow of the late Bo Biden, and the girlfriend of, or whatever, paramour of Hunter Biden, who, anyway, the thing that has people shaking their heads a little bit is that Haley Biden is potentially going to be called as a witness in the trial of Hunter Biden. And we're talking about a matter of days. That trial is supposed to get underway the first week of June. So that has some people wondering why he made a 15-minute stop over at her home. His motorcade stopped there on the way to the Delaware National Guard station, where he would lift off on Marine One and go back to the White House. There was an NBC, I believe, reporter who reported that, the stop, and said, you know, the anniversary of Bo, and then also just mentioned that that Haley Biden is scheduled to testify. And this reporter got a lot of grief from the left that said he should not have reported that it was bad form for him to do so, and of course, I'm being very mild. So that's Biden's story number one. Story number two today is in the Daily Mail, exclusive. Joe and Hunter Biden used a visit to Sandy Hook Memorial Service to set up a secret meeting with Chinese officials or corporate officials, however you want to call them, operatives, over a $10 million deal that the Bidens were taking part in. And we could go into details about that. The details are in the Daily Mail today, and now they're being spread throughout the media. Will we ever, Dean, get to the bottom of the Biden family and the money and the relation to foreign governments, number one? Number two, does this story about this Joe Biden stop over the shared wife-girlfriend, Haley Biden, was that surprising in any way?
I don't think so, and I don't think that anything's really to be gained by going after it, as much as we might think we know what was talked about there. But the larger story would be, I think, that ties both of those questions together, that Biden doesn't seem to have any division between his personal life and his office. He doesn't seem to have knowledge of things that he shouldn't do. Like doing it in the middle of the night, it makes it already, it's going to look shady. We know he's not usually up in the middle of the night. He usually puts a lid on things by 2 p.m. in the afternoon. It seems like he's sneaking in. I find it very interesting that reporters are telling another reporter, don't report things. It's kind of, you know, their job description is a verb. Report, you know, that's a verb. I think that you talk about getting to the bottom of these things. I think because Biden has skated for so long, he's never even considered that something might look bad. He has this ability to create reality throughout and use magical thinking. And he talks constantly about having, never mind how Bo passed away, but he talks about having cut the deficit by $1.7 trillion. And it's of course not true, but for the life of me, I can't believe not a single member, a Republican member of the U.S. House said, well, then you don't need to raise the debt ceiling, I guess, because you've been saying you cut the deficit. He conflates them with the debt all the time. He hasn't cut anything. Some of the COVID spending expired. As for the family and getting to the bottom of the family, I think the more we investigate it, the more he does shift back to just this, well, hi, I'm just this friendly, gregarious guy. And her said, right? He's a well-meaning, amiable elderly man with a bad memory. He's got that something-eating grin on that people just say, ah, well, it was his son. I remember I used to email Rush when we were there.
Yeah, but this is a guy who, I watched these press conferences, and you did too, where there were these adamant declarations that Joe Biden never had anything at all to do with his son's businesses, didn't know about him, two separate lives. That myth has been blown out of the water so much they don't even trot that line out anymore. So I don't know.
Switching reality. That's switching the reality for this guy. He can just jump right out of it and say, oh, that never happened. And he has a press. That's what that shows, that goes right along and says, okay, don't report that. Report the new reality.
All right, James Carville in the news again. He does a weekly, and I like playing the weekly. I didn't ask to get the sound from the weekly because the comments were short, and I can do it myself. James Carville was asked a question in his Politicon podcast. And he answers it this way. Why aren't blacks not coming home to the Democrats? Because the Democrat messaging is full of That's why. Talk about the cost of living, and we're going to help with this. Don't talk about effing Gaza and student loans. Why are we forgiving student loans for people to go to Harvard? Hedge fund that has classrooms. The hedge fund that has classrooms. So James Carville is still out bemoaning his party's messaging, and also bemoaning policy, this student loan giveaway. Any impact? Does anyone really in the Democrat Party pay attention to what Carville is saying? Does it make sense from a political standpoint, Dean?
Well, I think if they weren't going to listen to Bill Clinton anymore, as Hillary didn't when he said maybe you should go up to Wisconsin and do a do a little stop and a walkthrough campaign a little. And she said, no, no, we have Wisconsin in the bag in 2016. Then I don't think they're going to be listening to Carville anymore. I think the party is so in the thrall, and it's true of Republicans in a sense, too, because of just the way redistricting is and how you raise money now. You raise money by really whipping up that small group of real true believers that are rabidly against the other side, that believe anything and everything that you say about them and cast at them. Look at yesterday, if you saw, there was a tweet by the Biden campaign headquarters that said the people at the Libertarian Party were chanting hypocrite at Trump, which seemed weird to me. And they weren't. They were chanting end the Fed, which is what they chant for everything. Instead of happy birthday, they say end the Fed. So it's, the Fed. People believe it. People believe it.
All right. Historian, columnist, author, all-around good guy, Dean Terrianis is with us. We will discuss the history of Memorial Day, this day that we're all celebrating, a little bit later. I still have some news items to talk about with Dean. As you can see, his analysis and take on things is expert. Heavenly birthday today for Ramsey Lewis, American jazz composer, pianist, and also a radio personality. Ramsey Lewis broke on the scene in a big way back in 1965 with an album, The In Crowd, which I listened to when we were kids. My mom loved that album, and so we grew up listening to it and loving it. But Ramsey Lewis would record in his career over 80 albums. And he is just an amazing, he was an amazing musician, amazing composer. This one was with Earth, Wind, and Fire. He had a long-standing relationship with Maurice White. And they came up with this one. This was, I think, debuted on the Gratitude album, which was Earth, Wind, and Fire's fourth album. And became a huge hit for Ramsey Lewis. A huge pop hit. Sun Goddess. On WABC Talk Radio 77, Dean Carianis is with us. I'll call him America's historian. All right, Dean, I want to turn our attention to overseas, and I want to get your reaction. This is not the usual kind of news story we do, but I'm curious as to your take on this. We do not want nakedness in our culture, is the headline. Nigeria's first lady slams influence of some American stars on country's women in speech weeks after Meghan and Harry's visit. So the royal kids, Meghan and Harry, went over to Nigeria. This is with this Invictus Games business that used to be a big deal, not so much anymore. The first lady of the country, who is also a senator, Senator Ulrimi Tinubu, who has the nickname Mummy, like in Mum, by some Nigerian senators, said, "We have to salvage our children. We see the way they dress. We're not having the Met Gala. And everyone, the nakedness is just everywhere. And the men are well clothed. So we have to do something. Tell them we don't accept nakedness in our culture. That is not beautiful. It's not beautiful at all." And this was a speech that she delivered to Nigeria's women in the wake of Harry and Meghan's cultural visit. Meghan, of course, claims that DNA shows she's blah, blah, blah percentage Nigerian. Why did she come here looking for Africa? This is something we have to take home with us. We know who we are. Don't lose who you are, was the message to Nigerian women. Don't dress like these scantily clad American with nakedness everywhere. What's your take on that, Dean?
It reminds me of that brief president they had in Egypt, Mohamed Morsi, who said, "We don't want your naked restaurants here." I guess he was thinking of Hooters, and I know that that turned many, many Americans against him. Maybe that's why they ultimately dumped him out and got somebody new, because they said, "Hey, we're going to fight tooth and nail." Not many things Americans seem to agree on anymore, but our beloved naked restaurants, there seems to be quite a quorum to support them. But seriously, though, I think it's very important. You listen to some people who speak about it and speak about morality issues. Everyone is poo-pooed at. Even people who talk about human trafficking and people who talk about the damage that prostitution does to people, especially young women, of course, and morality, nobody seems to want to speak about that anymore at all. Terry Crews is somebody in Hollywood, a big name, who talks about the damage that pornography does to people and how what are we doing to young people's minds? And we're constantly flashing these images of kids. You and I are both old enough to remember when, gosh, you just see a little bit, not quite ankle like back in James Madison's day, but you just see a woman in a bathing suit. That Farrah Fawcett poster was on millions of walls in the 70s of her in a bathing suit. She didn't need to be naked. And you sound a little bit old-fashioned to say it, but I think when you're thinking about young people, thinking about general morals, it's not a leap from there to having people wear a burqa. We're not talking about that, but I could see a country that has different morals, which we're told we have to respect, that they don't want that to be imported into their country, that they do see that there are damages, as there are with anything, to carrying that too far and being completely immodest and welcoming in thoughts that probably corrupt, I guess, their youth.
Well, men have those thoughts regardless. Men have those thoughts if women are in a potato sack from head to toe. But, I mean, yeah, you raised the point. What I like is we're all supposed to respect diversity, right? Well, here's some diversity. How about respecting that point of view? Let me quickly, before we have to stop down for traffic and Kim Komando, let me ask you to listen to something that was on Disgrace the Nation this weekend. Pete Buttigieg, our transportation secretary, was interviewed about the rollout of these electric chargers around the country. Dean, listen to this segment from that interview and give me your impression of it. Hit it, Dig.
The Federal Highway Administration says only 7 or 8 charging stations have been produced with a $7.5 billion investment that taxpayers made back in 2021. Why isn't that happening more quickly?
So the president's goal is to have 500,000 chargers up by the end of this decade. Now, in order to do a charger, it's more than just plunking a small device into the ground. There's utility work, and this is also really a new category of federal investment. But we've been working with each of the 50 states. Every one of them is getting formula dollars to do this work, engaging them in the first handful. Again, by 2030, 500,000 chargers, and the very first handful of chargers are now already being physically built.
Dean, billions of dollars. Billions of dollars.
Yeah.
They've got 7 or 8. It was reported on Fox News. The actual number is 4. 4 charges. Elon Musk has charges all over with Tesla all over the country for far less money. What's your take on this?
Electric cars are insane the way they're trying to do it. First of all, the first cars were electric. Speaking of history, there's a map I have of Manhattan. I should tweet it to you from @HistoryDean, which is me on Twitter, of the charging stations they had there over 100 years ago. But we switched to gasoline because it was more efficient. You could go farther with it. You didn't have to go in search of a charging station. But the government, the way that they're doing it, they're banning in California, they're not going to sell any more gas-powered cars. Biden has said he wants to do the same thing or is mandating the same thing. And it's only a few years away that they think they can do that. And I, at the New York Sun, when I write about this, I describe it as putting the cart before the horse and then shooting the horse. Because we're just going to tell you, no car.
This guy's not all embarrassed to try to wing this.
No.
Well, you know, this is a new kind of expense for the federal government. We want to put 500,000 of these things out there by 2030. And the woman laughs at him. It's like, please, who are you trying to snow with this?
You're about to do traffic. Imagine people stuck in traffic in an electric car needing to charge.
Boom. Absolutely. With us, our historian, America's historian, Dean Karyanis. Dean, there's a piece today in the Washington Post. It's on the opinion page. Basically, the gist of it is, after you get through all the what is this column really about, it's time to reconfigure and move Memorial Day to restore its meaning. In other words, Memorial Day should not be just another one of the three-day weekends that Americans love. Americans, we love the three-day weekends. But the point of this opinion piece is that to give Memorial Day its proper due, we should celebrate it on May 30th, the day that it was intended to be recognized. So I set that up to, why don't you walk us through, Dean, Memorial Day, the origins, the history of it. I don't know whether you agree with that, that we should not just roll this into another three-day weekend, that somehow it loses a little bit of meaning if we do that.
Yeah, I'm sitting here reflecting on it because it is an interesting thought that it would be just like July 4th where you mark it on the day that it falls. The 4th is always the 4th, doesn't move around. It was 1971 that they fixed the date where it is now, the last Monday in May. Before that, you had a lot of states celebrating it a lot of different times. So I'm sitting here thinking because my column, as it happens in the New York Sun today, is about 1916 and the parade in New York City, and they celebrated it on a Tuesday. And back in 1916, they probably weren't like we are today where they said, great, that means a four-day weekend because I'll sneak in. And it was really about, they had the oldest man marching in that parade was as far back as the Mexican War. They had guys there from the Spanish-American War. Of course, lots of Civil War, 750 Civil War veterans were marching at the time. But states had divided it up and moved it around, and some of them still celebrated it as Jefferson Davis's birthday. And it was originally Decoration Day by the Confederacy when the widows and daughters and mothers would go decorate the graves. And then it was taken over by the Union, by the victorious side, by America became a more blanket holiday. But by 1916, there were still a whole bunch of states that celebrated then. And the Union would celebrate it on the date that Union soldiers captured Jefferson Davis and tossed his ass in the brig. And so I think the date you talk about, you always have a little sense. You know, people talk about the good old days. People weren't bitter. They didn't know how to hold a grudge. Well, there you go. They knew how to stick it to you. But it's interesting to me to talk about moving the date, but I can't. I don't know. I don't think it makes it less of a holiday to have it where it is now. I think in a way, maybe we could even argue the three-day weekend begins the commemoration. I always hesitate to say celebration or anything like that, but it starts it a little bit earlier because it's a three-day weekend. If it was just shoved in the middle of a week on a 30th, it was a Wednesday, would we really spend the whole week thinking and talking about it? I guess we do with Veterans Day, and it seems like Veterans Day passes pretty unremarked upon comparatively, maybe because it is in the middle of the week or wherever it just happens to fall.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm surprised, given the history that you laid out, and it started as Decoration Day, a Confederate holiday. Why do you think the left has... Oh, no, let me not break up this solemn day with frivolous, sarcastic remarks about banning things in our history, because we see plenty of that. But it did start as a Confederate holiday. It started as a Confederate holiday.
Yeah. People don't much like to think about or talk about the origin of some things, but this is one of those things that, unlike, say, a nursery rhyme that's offensive, they don't realize started it. Even Ring Around the Rosy, right? That's about kids dying from the plague. So we sometimes we look back, but this is something where they suffered such huge losses, which were their own fault, of course, and people who love them regardless, and we all have people like that, felt that they sacrificed and they wanted to go to their graves, put some flowers, remember them. And then the nation, it really tracks the nation, how the nation eventually goes from being the several states. People like to say, historians, it's a little pretentious that the Civil War made it from the United States are to the United States is. It changed that verb so that it was one nation. I think that that's something that maybe we can do a better job of remembering it is about the actual graves, but I don't know about moving the date the way we do Veterans Day. It's different anyway. Of course, veterans are still with us, and the two holidays should not be confused or not to be confused, but I don't know that moving it would do anything to change that. I think we'd be better off teaching people who those names are that are chiseled into various memorials around the country. There's about 150 memorials just to World War One in New York City, which is an incredible number when you think about it. I came from Kevin Fitzpatrick, his book on the Great War. I did an interview with him on the History Author show that I host. I think that to look at people that way, to look at it as a Confederate thing, I don't think we care where it came from. If somebody you love dies, if you're a three-year-old or a four-year-old, Theodore Roosevelt's mother was packaging up, had him as a four-year-old, packaging up boxes to send down through enemy lines to the Confederacy. I think when you love someone, you love them, you want to remember their sacrifice. And I hope that the Confederate origins never have anything to do with why or where we change it to.
Yeah. Well, Dean, I can't thank you enough for filling us in always on some of the history of this great nation of ours. You are quite knowledgeable about so many things about America. And I always learn something. No matter how much I think I know about history, I can always learn something from you. Again, Dean, tell people where they can find you, please.
They can find me at historyauthor.com for the History Author Show. They can find me at nysun.com for my columns. They can find me at History Dean on Twitter. And they can find me wherever fine podcasts talk and Rambling Man, since you play the Allman Brothers, Rambling Men are found.
Thank you, Dean. Dean Karyanis, the Bo Snerdly Rush Hour's historian, and indeed James Golden Show, and on Saturdays as well. Dean will be here whenever there's a holiday. We always plan to have Dean with us to talk about the significance of it. Dean, thank you so much.